Hello and welcome to this latest IRF podcast. The Independent Research Forum was established by Edward Blatt in 2015 to introduce best-in-class independent research providers to institutional investors. I'm JP Smith, and with me today is Nicholas Watson, Managing Director from Tenio Political Risk Advisory, covering the Spanish-speaking Latin American markets. And Nicholas has just come back from Argentina, which, as many of you are aware, very, very topical subject at the moment with the election of the new president. So we'll get into the meat of this later. But Nicholas, perhaps you could start today with a brief description of Tenio and of your own background and coverage focus.
Sure. Hi, JP. Yeah, Tenio works in political risk forecasting. We can analyze sort of top of mind risk events, explore probability drivers and signposts, and we monitor these risk events and carry out assessments for various types of client. We also do scenario planning and workshops. We can identify how political situations unfold and signposts to help clients identify relevant movements towards these outcomes. And then we can obviously help clients prepare kind of responses and strategies for dealing with the various scenarios as they unfold. And we can also do due diligence for clients looking to close on deals and requiring more background information on political, economic, sectoral risks in the countries that we cover. And these can be highly specialized assessments that identify, you know, any potential red flags heading into a deal. So that's a kind of roundup of what we do. And I head up the coverage of Spanish-speaking Latin America, so mainly focused on the big markets like Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, and so on, but also looking at the more esoteric frontier markets in the region as well. I have lived in Mexico, in Colombia, Brazil, and Cuba. I'm currently based in London and have spent 20 years covering the region, including Argentina.
That's great. I mean, there's an awful lot there, but we should start certainly with Argentina, since that's where you've just come back from. Perhaps we could start with a little bit of context on Argentina, how we got to where we are now, maybe a sort of very brief history of previous stabilization efforts and what the newly elected president is actually trying to achieve.
Sure. Yeah, the new government's been in power for just over 3 months. Under President Javier Milei, very much an outsider who came from really kind of obscurity, not a politician in his background. He's an economist. And he really rose to prominence on the back of a couple of successive governments, both of which, of differing political stripes, have really struggled to get to grips with long-standing economic stagnation and periods of recession and crisis. So between 2015 and 2019, you had the government led by Mauricio Macri, a business-friendly center-right government, which entered into a very large deal with the IMF, tried to enact some structural changes to the Argentine economy, but tried to do so because it lacked political latitude, tried to do so kind of with a gradualist approach. That effort failed and the Peronists were re-elected, Peronists being the kind of catch-all movement that has dominated Argentine politics really for over 60 years. And over the last 20 years, the Peronist movement has been dominated by a more kind of left-leaning, radical, sort of heterodox movement called Kirchnerismo after Néstor Kirchner, who was the president after the 2001 economic crisis, and then led by his wife, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner. The Peronist government that Cristina sort of dominated, although she wasn't the president, also ended in failure after a very difficult 4 years. And that the fact that we had two different successive governments coming at things from different directions, but that both failed, really paved the way for, I think, a huge frustration among Argentine voters that led them to vote for Milei, which really represented a kind of a leap into the political unknown. And we're just beginning to see how that's unfolding now.
In terms of the people that supported Millier and actually voted for him, was there any notable shift? For example, demographic, was it young people who were frustrated with the system? I think as well in Argentina, there's always been this divide, hasn't there, between Buenos Aires and some of the provinces. And I gather the provincial governors are quite powerful. Is there any sort of shift in the underlying political economy that's resulted in his election?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. The demographic that Milei managed to appeal to very successfully was the more youthful voter, particularly people between the ages of 20 and 30, kind of mainly lower middle class. So no particularly strong memory of the dictatorship that ended 40 years ago, quite frustrated by this economic stagnation, the lack of opportunities, by corruption. And so they were very open to Milei's rhetoric about tackling corruption and about radical economic reform. And Milei had a very colourful campaign in which he wielded a chainsaw as a kind of metaphor for how he would tackle this bloated Argentine state. So that was absolutely key to his victory. And then when it came to the runoff vote, because the election in 2023 took place over two rounds, when it came to the runoff vote, he was then able to appeal to a lot of the more established, perhaps middle, upper middle class sectors who had supported Mauricio Macri in 2015 and who were supporting his candidate, who was one of his former ministers called Patricia Bullrich. She didn't make it into the runoff, but then she went and endorsed Milei for that runoff. And that sort of alliance between Milei's younger youth vote and lower middle class vote, particularly in the very densely populated area around Buenos Aires, married to that kind of more traditional center-right vote, gave him victory.
In the sort of early 1990s, I covered Central and Eastern Europe, and so I spent a lot of time looking at the sort of stabilization efforts in places like Poland, for example. I'm not talking about Russia here. Russia was very different. And one of the things that made those stabilizations relatively successful was a feeling that they just couldn't go on as they were doing before. So the population were willing to accept some quite big sacrifices, and they were more patient, I think, than many people would have expected at the outset. How patient do you think Milei's supporters are likely to be? And I'm sure you'll come onto this when you talk about your visit, because it does seem to be already a real roller coaster and difficult for him to get the support that he needs to push reform through. So in other words, how much time do you think he has?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Actually, public opinion is fairly solid so far. Obviously, we're only a little over 3 months in. But I think that Milei's frustration with the kind of traditional politics and his recipe for a way out of Argentina's long-term stagnation and crisis really has resonance. There was a pollster I was speaking to last week in Buenos Aires who had been running some focus groups. And there was one sort of sentence that a few people in her focus groups had kind of come up with, which was something had to change. And I think that's a really important expression of sentiment that, as I was mentioning earlier, two governments with very different approaches to the economy had both failed. And so that, I think, gave some license for Milei to come along with his much more radical plans, encompassing, you know, shock therapy, which is anathema to most Argentines. And yet, on this occasion in late 2023, you know, there was a vote for exactly that. So there is public backing. It's not universal, of course. Milei won, you know, a little over 50% in the election. If you look at the polls, his support has dropped a little bit, unsurprisingly, given the tough economic situation, which we can talk about later. But, you know, not by as much as you might think. His approval numbers are still fairly resilient. And if you look at the polls, again, there's still optimism that this tough, painful economic medicine can lead somewhere brighter, can produce deeper reforms. And of course, it helps that the opposition, which is very fragmented, is quite weak, that the Peronist opposition, which is the main sort of movement that Milei is up against, is pretty discredited, really, after the last 4 years. So at the moment, public opinion is fairly solid. How long that lasts, that's one of the key questions. He hasn't got a blank check. If you ask people, you know, how long are you prepared to put up with inflation at these kind of very, very high levels, you can see that patience will wear thin. I think we're entering a critical period really from now, from March, and I think that will run into April, May. And they really need to deliver or show signs of green shoots by May, June. And Milei is aware of that, and that's why, you know, he is very, very keen to bring in monthly inflation down to single digits. At the moment, it's in double digits. But I think that would be a good sign, and a sign that, you know, things are moving in the right direction.
So the main drivers of inflation presumably are the exchange rate moves. Perhaps you could update us on that, and also the fiscal situation as well, because I mean, Argentina's been in an era on the fiscal dominance for some time, hasn't it? So what's the latest on how to bring down inflation?
Yeah, on the fiscal side, the kind of macro plan is extremely ambitious, encompassing a huge fiscal adjustment of 5% of GDP to reach fiscal balance by the end of this year. And they want to achieve that mainly through spending cuts, which they're implementing already. I mean, that goes beyond what the IMF originally planned under the program. So this is hugely ambitious.
Sorry, Nicholas, can you just update us in terms of where we are with the IMF program? Because I'm not sure I'm aware.
Yeah, so there is an IMF program. It's just had its seventh review. So it was signed under the previous government. It basically went off track under the previous government quite drastically. Milei promised to bring it back on track, and even more than bring it back on track, but go beyond the targets that had been set originally as part of that program. There has been a review since Milei came to power, and a new disbursement was green-lighted for $4.7 billion. The IMF had been sort of requiring what they call prior actions, which is the IMF speak for, we need to see some real positive progress and real sort of commitment to improving the fiscal situation, improving central banks' reserves, these kind of areas. And Milei has delivered on that. The reserves were in a very, very fragile state. Net reserves were negative to the tune of over $15 billion when Milei came to office. He has managed to accumulate about $10 billion. So they're still net negative, but, you know, definitely heading back in the right direction. The fiscal targets are sort of on track. January was a very positive month. They delivered twin surpluses, the first monthly budget surplus since 2012, and a trade surplus as well. So that was all really positive and obviously contributed to this latest passage of the latest review. The IMF's role, just while we're talking about the IMF, it's quite interesting. As far as a kind of the possibility of a fresh program, new funds, it doesn't seem to be imminent. The government's not talking about it. And as far as I understand, there are no formal talks on a fresh program. But I think it's something that's kind of in the drawer, should they need it perhaps later this year or at some future point. And the other important thing to note about the IMF relationship right now is that actually, contrary to what the casual observer might think, because Milei has been pushing so hard and his adjustment plan is so painful, it's actually the IMF that's been saying to Milei, you know, just hold on. For this to be a sustainable program of reforms, it's really better if you get as broad a political buy-in as you possibly can. So that's quite interesting. Yeah, and I think they're right. The fund is absolutely spot on that. And then we can talk about the politics of what's going on as well, because Milei is very aggressive. He's very confrontational. He can alienate even his own allies. And so when you look at the structural agenda over the last 3 months, you know, this is the agenda to deregulate the economy, shrink the size of the state, privatize various state companies, introduce labor reforms. The structural agenda has actually mostly hit a wall.
In a way, that's not surprising, is it? I mean, to immediately stabilize the economy, I suppose this shock therapy in the form of immediate sort of fiscal measures comes first. And then after that, maybe he could start thinking about privatization, deregulation, all the other sort of structural reforms. I mean, maybe the IMF are correct and trying to do everything very quickly in that area just does run the risk of coalitions building up against what you're trying to do.
Yeah, it does. And what he has tried to pass, he's sort of worked on two different routes. One, a huge legislative bill of reforms originally contained 664 different measures that he sent through as one package to Congress, and that collapsed in February. But in parallel, he sent a presidential decree, so not requiring legislative approval, that was 366 different measures. So we're talking about over 1,000 different kind of reforms. Now, his argument, in riposte to the point you just made, was, I don't have much time. My window of opportunity is very small, and I need to move fast, and I need to move now. That's debatable as to whether he was correct. I think they did include a lot of elements that really were a distraction and were divisive and caused the agenda to slow down and then eventually collapse. But the point is, there's kind of two tracks. On the macro stabilization plan, things have gone about as smoothly as you could have expected, particularly looking at those January results I was talking about earlier. But on the kind of longer term agenda and the reform agenda, pretty much nothing has moved at all.
Yeah. And what about the exchange rate? What's been happening? It's both an input and an output in terms of the stabilization program.
Yeah. The government devalued shortly after coming to office. And obviously that in itself creates challenges, because obviously it contributed hugely to the kind of inflationary spike that we saw really in December, and well, we're still seeing, although it's now on a downward path for now at least, but obviously needed to be done. And actually, we've seen kind of relative exchange rate stability over the last few weeks. When I was in Buenos Aires, the blue rate, which is the name they give to the main kind of black market dollar rate, was actually at pretty much parity with another rate they have for credit card use, which they call the MEP, the MEP rate. It's a huge thicket of complicated exchange rates that the previous government put in place. So, you know, unwinding that completely will take time. They want to avoid another devaluation, because obviously that would push up inflation. And the expectation of another devaluation also creates problems, because it makes farmers basically sit on their harvests. And I'm mainly talking about soybean here, which is obviously this huge agricultural commodity, highly important to Argentina's economy. And the harvest is kind of about to start. It takes place March, April sort of period. But if farmers perceive that a devaluation is possible, then they hold on to their stocks and wait. And that's not good for the government, which needs them to be selling their stock so that they can benefit from the export taxes that they levy on those agricultural commodities. So for now, there's relative stability on that front.
So in very naive sort of purchasing power parity terms, for you coming from the UK, going to Argentina, how expensive, how cheap is it? What sort of feel when you have a meal? And I know this is a very banal observation, but it's one that can be quite useful sometimes when trying to gauge where we are.
Absolutely. The exchange rate last week was about 1,000 pesos to the dollar. The problem is that because of import protectionism, it means that some things are incredibly cheap and some things are really expensive. And sorry, not just protectionism, but also subsidies. So because of subsidies on the cost of public transport, transport costs are very cheap. Fuel subsidies, although they're being corrected and withdrawn currently, it's still relatively cheap if you're coming from a kind of Western economy. So a taxi ride in Buenos Aires is incredibly cheap.
And these were a big part of the deficit, weren't they? The subsidies were a big part of the fiscal deficit.
Exactly. Yeah. Energy subsidies, particularly utility tariffs, have been hugely subsidized and a major contributor to the fiscal deficit. So they're absolutely key to unwinding these subsidies. Macri tried to do it in the 2015 to 2019 period, but had to move very gradually. Milei has more latitude to move at pace, but it's still politically sensitive for him. And one of the key issues he's going to face in this sensitive period that we've got ahead, say these next 3-4 months, is how much pain is there for ordinary people taking the bus, buying food when prices, the regime of subsidies is being kind of unwound like this.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of those people will be people that have voted for him. I mean, you mentioned people from a sort of younger demographic who presumably have relatively little in terms of disposable income. I imagine a lot of them, well into their 30s, live with their parents, and people sort of subsist in that kind of way. So again, it's a question of how much patience that they have. Perhaps, given that you've just sort of travelled there, perhaps say a little bit more about what you found out on the political front in terms of the potential support and opposition and how that is functioning at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, Milei, from a structural point of view, is governing with a hyper minority. He controls 15% of the lower house and 10% of the Senate. So he's not even anywhere close to having majorities in the legislature. And that compares to Mauricio Macri, who had about 1 in 3 lower house seats and maybe 1 in 5 Senate seats. So he's in a weaker position than Macri. He's in the weakest position of any president since the return to democracy. Now, normal political behavior might mean that to build governability, you would reach out to other like-minded parties, try and construct a majority or a coalition, or at least ad hoc majorities for bills that you want to pass. Milei doesn't really work like that. He seems to think he can govern by decree, that he can bypass Congress or somehow put up a containing wall around Congress and just ignore it. And that's one of the reasons why, as we were saying earlier, the IMF has kind of been nudging him to broaden his support base and obtain this kind of wider buy-in for his program. It's a strange strategy. It led to the collapse of his big omnibus bill of reforms, the 664 measures that he was trying to pass that collapsed in February. He's since sort of made an effort to relaunch many of those proposals, and that's a process that's currently underway. And so he's reached out to provincial governors in an effort to get some of this agenda through. But it's strange. At the same time as he reaches out to the other side, he also criticizes them. He attacks them. He's called Congress a nest of rats. He calls them traitors. You know, he's pretty aggressive in his language.
Yes, so he's not really going out to win friends and influence people. He's rather appealing over their heads, isn't he, to the masses and saying, look, it's these guys' fault.
Exactly. And that's part of his appeal. That's part of his pitch during the campaign, was to say that he was an outsider, that he wasn't a member of the political establishment, that he describes as a caste, la casta. Something that he's constantly talking about, that they're corrupt, self-serving, venal, which, you know, is rhetoric that works to an extent, but he won power as a disruptor. I'm not sure you can necessarily govern as a disruptor. And, you know, if you look at one crucial area where I think his strategy I really question is that presidential decrees don't cover, they can't cover tax related issues. So any kind of fiscal reforms that he wants to put in place need to go through Congress. He can't push them by decree.
Is Congress dominated by the provincial governors? Are they the sort of kingmakers, as it were?
They are, in a way. Provincial governors kind of are the puppet masters to a lot of legislators sitting in Congress. Not all of them, and that's a little bit of a crude kind of picture, but yeah, provincial governors are absolutely key.
Are they a homogenous group, or I guess they all have different interests, right, as well?
They come from different parties. Millet doesn't have a single provincial governor from his party. They're all from different parties. But, you know, he's picked fights with governors that have expressed support and sympathy for his program. So, you know, it's a strange situation. On the 1st of March, in his address to Congress, Millet made this appeal to provincial governors, and he followed up with a meeting in the Casa Rosada, the presidential palace. And he wants to have a kind of grand national unity pact that he wants to have sealed by the end of May. I'm pretty skeptical both that that can succeed and that he's genuine about it. I think he might be instead trying to buy time to kind of keep the governors busy for now, in the hope that between now and the end of May, disinflation is clear, the economy is showing signs of improvement, and somehow that, if it materializes, boosts his approval numbers and sort of forces provincial governors to the table and obliges them to come to some kind of agreement with him. That, I think, is his plan.
That's when you can also start thinking about structural reform as well, because at the moment there's no point, from what you're saying, that we can really meaningfully talk about things like privatization. I mean, he has plans, but do you have a view? I mean, is there a possibility of him doing that in the sort of short, medium term, or should we just wait out and see what's happening on the stabilization front?
He has watered down his privatization plans. Originally, he had a list of, I think it was 41 different state-run entities and companies that he wanted to privatize. That now has been reduced to a little bit more than a dozen, I think it is, that they're now thinking of putting up for privatization. The privatizations, part of this is being pushed in a decree. And when you sign a presidential decree, it takes effect immediately. It only doesn't take effect, or it only stops having legal effect, when both chambers of Congress vote against it. And that's never happened in Argentina's democracy. But actually yesterday, the 14th of March, the Senate rejected his main decree. So that's a huge setback for the privatization agenda. Now, it's still in effect because you need both chambers to reject it. But my point is that it's just not exactly confidence building if you're an investor looking at an asset that was previously state run, to think that the only legal basis for this is a presidential decree that could be overturned at any moment. So I think the privatization agenda is kind of in wait and see mode.
Is there anything else that came out of your visit that you'd like to talk about?
Another aspect, I think, which is really important to mention, is just the level of confusion and chaos within the government. We've talked about confrontation and how confrontational Milei can be. But I think as well, it's just important to note that this is a very inexperienced team. Apart from the economic team, I sort of separate them. The economy minister, Luis Caputo, is experienced and is very capable and competent and has the trust of markets and investors. So that, you know, that's positive. But the kind of political team, it has very limited experience. It's a very small group of people that surround Milei. And it's not often clear who on the government side has the authority to make significant decisions. they often undermine each other. They don't know all the legislative rules about procedures and how things work in the legislature. They seem to lack mitigation strategies or plan Bs, if you will. And as I said, Milei and his team, you know, frequently criticize, attack, and alienate people and parties that they need on their side. And I mean, including, you know, the vice president herself, for example, or people from Mauricio Macri's party, which is very sympathetic to the Milei agenda. And it's kind of not in a formal alliance, but in a kind of de facto support arrangement with Milei's party. So I think that complicates the picture greatly and it makes things very uncertain and difficult to predict.
Igor Gaidar, who was the leader of the first post-Soviet government in 1991-1992, once described his stabilization shock therapy plan as kamikaze government. And in the end, they managed to do a lot of what they wanted to do, but they could only do it by bringing the vested interests on board. And one thing that's coming through loud and clear from what you're saying, Nicholas, is that there's a, you know, already signs that Milei has failing to do that. This might seem a rather bizarre question, but do you think he expects to succeed?
Yeah, no, I don't think that's a bizarre question. I think that's a very pertinent question, even though this is a government that's only 3 months old. I'm not sure is the answer, but I think we have to consider the possibility, given Argentine history, that not only he doesn't succeed, but that he doesn't last the full term. Whether how he might go is really not clear, but you know there is a precedent of a president being removed by public pressure on the streets. He faces a difficult position in Congress. As I said, the opposition is fragmented, but his party is in a very, very extreme minority. And I have to say, there is a question about his mental state, his psychology. You know, he is erratic. He is also a purist and an ideologue of sorts. And I wonder, and this is just my sort of personal speculation, but, you know, I'm not the only person wondering this. Would he rather fail but remain pure and true to his principles than compromise, dilute his program and quote unquote succeed in stabilizing the situation? It's not clear. His vice president, who I mentioned earlier, because they're at loggerheads with each other already, is appearing to be sort of keeping her distance from Milei, perhaps. This is speculation again, but thinking that, you know, there is a possibility that Milei doesn't last the full term and that she ends up needing to succeed him. There's a lot of ifs for that scenario to develop. And of course, if Milei fails, it might be that his entire government is swept away and that she, Victoria Villarroel, doesn't necessarily succeed him. There's another scenario, of course, which is he moderates, that he's prepared to compromise with provincial governors, with Congress, that he makes a more conscious effort to build governability. And perhaps he reaches out to people in Mauricio Macri's team who can give him a little bit more experience on how things work and can provide kind of more moderate bridge builders in Congress to push through an agenda, not the perfect agenda of Milei's vision, but something that enables Argentina to kind of return to a more sustainable path of growth.
Or even that he were to step down, his successor, if it was the person that you mentioned, would be able to carry on his work and again, implement this slightly less extreme or polarizing version of his work. And if by then the stabilization plan was starting to produce some results, then that might also help. So maybe it's not such a binary scenario. There are all these nuances which you've highlighted.
Yeah, Absolutely. But I would just say in Argentina, there are kind of three basic elements of governability. And we talked a lot about Congress, which is obviously one. There's also the street. There's already been a general strike in January, shortly after he came to office, which was very unusual. There wasn't a single general strike under the previous government. Unions are not popular. They're quite discredited because they're seen as corrupt, rightly so. But, you know, they are still powerful actors in the Argentine political system. And if inflation isn't a kind of a linear downward process, if there are corruption scandals, if there are other problems that emerge, then you can easily see unions mobilizing on the streets and potentially causing problems. So that's the second area of governability. And then the third area is the courts, which we haven't talked about, but I don't think they're not fully in the picture now. There has been a legal challenge to one important plank of Milei's decree that he issued in December, which is centers on labor reforms. So these are all basically paused pending a judicial review. And it could be that the entire rest of the presidential decree, which contains, you know, these dozens and dozens of reforms, also ends up at the Supreme Court. And it could be that the Supreme Court has to make a judgment eventually about a lot of the legality and constitutionality of Milei's reforms. And that puts the court in a very sensitive position, and potentially we see a kind of a clash of institutions at some point in the next few months between Milei and the Supreme Court. So that's another area I think we need to watch in the future.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating, Nicholas, and you've outlined a number of different scenarios. My sense is we've only really scratched the surface of your knowledge. There is a lot of interest at the moment from our clients in Argentina, both on the debt and actually to a lesser extent on the equity side. So surprisingly, the equity market, having been one of the best performing of emerging markets, perhaps if you exclude Taiwan, over the last sort of 1, 3, and even on a 10-year view, surprisingly respectable performance. And at the moment, Argentinian US dollar debt is trading towards the top of its range, but obviously it's still relatively, in inverted commas, cheap. Although given the history of defaults, I think you'd have to be fairly brave to consider investing at this level. So this is indicative of the sort of research that Tenio undertakes. I'm fortunate enough to see their research on the IRF research feed, and it's plentiful, in-depth, covers a vast range of geographies, and I'd encourage institutional investors out there to get in touch with the IRF, and we can put you in touch with Tenio. So Nicholas, thank you very much for that absolutely fascinating rundown of both the context and recent events in Argentina.
Thank you. Thank you very much, JP.